Just before we start the May Extra edition of the Jodcast, we've got a little question for you. Well, actually, it's more of a joke. How many astronomers does it take to change a street lamp bulb? That's how many astronomers does it take to change a street lamp bulb? The answer, after this. The Jodcast. Celebrating 1 year of extra editions. With David Ault, Stuart Lowe, Tim O'Brien and Nick Rattenbury. The Jodcast, May 2008 Extra Issue. Hello and welcome to the May Extra Edition of the Jodcast. Unfortunately, we have no Nick this month, but we do have Stuart. Hi.
Hi, Dave, and hi, listeners. Well, we do have Nick. He's just in pre-recorded form.
Ah, yes. Nick is not live.
He is alive, but...
He is alive, but not live. So, in the show, this issue. We talk to Dr. Anthony Challoner of the University of Cambridge about the CMB. We also ask your questions to our resident astronomer Tim O'Brien. But first, before all of that, here's your feedback. Stuart, what we got this time?
Okay, well, we had a few reviews on iTunes. We had a review from Blue Radio from Doug.va, who's an astronomy grad student in the US. We also had a review from Jai, or G? It's just J-I.
Ye, I'm not quite sure how you... probably, actually.
They said, the Jodcast is witty and informative, and long in a good way. We also had reviews from Muttley32, Starry David, who thoroughly recommends the recent NAMM edition, the two-hour blockbuster, as he called it.
Yes, that was a...
And also our very first review from New Zealand from Branscombe. So thank you very much to all of those people for giving us reviews on iTunes. And if you haven't yet given us a review on iTunes and you have iTunes on your computer, please go and give us a review.
Yes, please. The more 5 stars, the better.
So anyway, Dave, you've got our feedback from Facebook, which we haven't visited in a while.
Yes, I do. We have had a few wall posts, and just to bring you up to date with membership, we now have 158 members on the Facebook group. We've had a post from Jeremy Cameron Buck from the University of Manchester, who says that the Jodcast is one of the best podcasts he listens to. He loves the news, and also Ian Morrison's sultry tones speaking on the night sky, which are a great way to chill out while staring out the window at night.
Of course, he's slightly biased because he's from the University of Manchester, but apart from that...
Andrew Hobson loves the Jodcast and says it's the most fantastic and diverse collection of accents he's heard in a single podcast. And Rapid Eye says that they just figured they wander over here and spread some graffiti.
Ah, Rapid Eye. We've had reviews from Rapid Eye before.
Yes. They've been listening for a while now, and they love to hear it while they're at the scope out in my pasture, which is
very impressive.
Yeah, over in North Carolina. And that is the news from Facebook.
Okay, and to the emails. We've had an email from Malcolm Stone, who has been listening to us on a cruise ship going through the Panama Canal and has been listening to us while in the gym on the treadmill. So it's great to hear about the many different exciting places that people are when they listen to the Jodcast. Also, thanks to Martin Watts, who provided the joke that you will hear in the intro and outro this time. And also thanks to Magiel Janssen, who says it's a great show and can never be too long. And by the way, aren't astronomers just the coolest people ever? And he also loves the abbreviations that we think of.
Yeah, I suppose there are some people that just don't spend long enough on thinking up abbreviations with such things as the Very Large Array.
A good abbreviation recently has been OWL, the Overwhelmingly Large Telescope. Although it has been scoped back a little bit from 100 metres to 42, so now it's just being called the Extremely Large Telescope, which is a bit more boring.
But then again, it's not just astronomers who think up stupid abbreviations for things. For example, in Cambridge, one of the maths departments is called DAMPT, which is otherwise known as the Department of Applied Mathematics and Theoretical Physics. And Dr. Anthony Challoner is our interviewee and works in DAMPT, and Nick caught up with him to find out about the cosmic microwave background.
Okay, so your research is into the cosmic microwave background, right?
That's right.
give us a bit of a backgrounder on the cosmic microwave background. What is it?
The cosmic microwave background is really the oldest light that we can observe in the universe. We believe that this radiation was produced at very, very early times, basically when the light nuclei formed in the universe. And our best evidence for this is that it has a spectrum, so a dependence on frequency or wavelength of the radiation, which is very well described by what's called a black body spectrum. Mm-hmm. So this is the same sort of spectrum as you would get if you had a hot object like the sun, for example. Whereas the surface of the sun is at a few thousand Kelvin, the microwave background is only at a few Kelvin, 2.7 Kelvin. So the interpretation of this is that it was produced when the universe was very dense, very hot at a very early time. Everything has this nice black body spectrum, and then the expanding universe has cooled that radiation. It's stretched out the wavelength of all the radiation, and we end up with radiation at a much lower temperature, which is what we observe today. So the microwave background was first discovered at the end of the 1960s, and since then, the interest has really been to look for fluctuations in the temperature of that radiation. And the fluctuations are essentially imprinted by clumping in the way matter is distributed in the universe at early times.
When we talk about fluctuations in the CMB, the cosmic microwave background, we're talking about fluctuations in space, aren't we, in position, rather than in time.
That's right. So all we can really do at the moment is look at different directions on the sky and see how the temperature in one direction compares to another. It is a very interesting issue about what the time dependence of those fluctuations would be. But basically, as with everything in cosmology, things evolve on a very, very slow time scale. Mm. So billions of years, basically. So if we waited long enough, things would look different in time.
But to us, we just see a snapshot of
Right.
And the thing with the, when you have a hot object and you suddenly make it bigger, which you can do in terms of how we think the universe expanded, then the temperature goes down because you've just expanded it. Wouldn't we expect, you know, what do we learn from what we see in these fluctuations? So you'd think that something which was very, very hot and you suddenly expanded it, it should be roughly the same temperature, right, everywhere you looked.
Right. So the point is that the temperature it's very nearly the same in all directions, but it's not quite. And those fluctuations are really small. They're at the level of about one part in 10 to the 5. Mm-hmm. And what these fluctuations are telling us about is basically the way, as I said, matter is clumped at a time when the universe was about a thousandth of its current size. So the way to think about this is say in some region of space you have an over-density of matter. So locally you have more matter than you do on average. Then as the microwave background radiation climbs away from that local blob of matter to reach us today, it's sort of climbing out of a gravitational potential well due to the matter. And due to general relativistic effects, so effects predicted by Einstein, what happens is that the wavelength of the radiation receives an extra stretching due to that climbing out of a potential well. And hence the radiation appears a little bit colder than it would otherwise. So on sort of large scales, so scales of a few degrees on the sky, if we see a blob in the temperature of the microwave background of that sort of scale that's colder than average, then that corresponds to a region in space when the universe was much smaller, which is more dense than average.
Okay, so there's interesting things coming out of this. First of all, you're measuring temperature differences one part in 100,000. Is that in real terms? Is that 100,000th of a Kelvin? Is that the difference in temperature that you're measuring?
That's right. So it's 100,000th of about 3 Kelvin.
That's remarkable.
So it requires remarkable technology to be able to do this. Yeah. And it's actually why the search for these fluctuations in temperature went on for a long time before anyone actually found anything. So the microwave background was first discovered, as I said, the middle of the 1960s. And it took until 1992 before these primordial fluctuations were actually detected. And even then, to detect them, people had to basically go out, well, people didn't, but they had to launch instruments out into space to be able to get away from things like the Earth's atmosphere, which glows very brightly and disturbs your measurements.
The measurements that had been taken prior to 1992, they showed pretty much what we expected, right? What I mentioned earlier was that everything seemed to be very, very flat in temperature distribution. It seemed to be what you'd expect if you took a regular object and expanded it. The temperature went down very, very evenly. But what happened in
1992 that was so exciting?
Okay, so, I mean, theorists for a long time had been predicting that there ought to be these fluctuations in temperature. And actually the field was sort of reaching crisis point where the theorists had been able to revise their models to sort of keep in line with the data. So the observationalists weren't seeing anything, so the theorists tweaked their theory a little bit. But things had got about as far as they could, so there basically wasn't any room for maneuver anymore. And if these fluctuations hadn't been detected, then basically our understanding of the way that matter evolves in the universe must have been fundamentally wrong. Fortunately, the fluctuations came at just the level that was being predicted at the time. So this was a sort of saving grace for our whole paradigm for how structure formed in the universe.
How were these fluctuations detected back in the early 90s?
So they were first detected by the COBE satellite, the Cosmic Background Explorer, and a particular instrument on that called the Differential Microwave Radiometer. And essentially it worked by performing what's called a differential measurement, which is a very good way of measuring. If you're trying to measure small differences in quantities, it's often easier, instead of trying to measure an absolute value, you measure a difference relative to some reference load. So essentially this is how the DMR instrument functioned. But essentially the technology was basically radio technology, so quite what is now old-fashioned technology.
So we should point out, of course, that it's a cosmic microwave background, so we observe in microwaves.
That's right, yeah. So these are frequencies of a few tens of gigahertz.
Let's go back to what you said earlier before. The cosmic microwave background basically shows us where the matter was when the radiation was released, when the universe was 1,000th of its size. It shows where the matter in the universe was. But how did the matter get there in the first place? What told the matter to clump in that particular way, in those particular regions?
So I mean, this is a sort of very outstanding question in cosmology at the moment. We'd like to understand. But what we believed happened was that in the very, very early universe, when the temperature of the universe was very, very high and matter was very, very dense, what we believed happened is that quantum processes were occurring on very small length scales, but they got stretched up by a process called cosmological inflation up to very large cosmological scales. So these quantum fluctuations are the same quantum fluctuations that are present all around us at the moment. So what we think of as the vacuum is actually a very interesting quantum mix of all sorts of activity going on. And there are, you know, virtual particles popping out of the vacuum all the time and then annihilating. And similar things were happening in the infant universe. But the thing that was different then was because of this very rapid expansion that we believe happened because of a particular form of matter that's posited to be present in the early universe, those fluctuations got stretched into essentially classical fluctuations. And what we then believe happened was that the matter that was, this strange matter that was causing the universe to undergo this cosmological inflation, this accelerated expansion, it then decayed into all the particles and the radiation that we now see around us. But during that decay, there was an imprint of how that inflationary matter was actually distributed because of these quantum fluctuations. So what we really believe we're seeing is quantum effects writ very, very large on the sky.
When we talk about very, very large, what sort of size are what are the sizes of these structures that we're talking about which were seeded by quantum fluctuations?
So if we think about the sort of scale of the observable universe, if we think about how far we can actually look back in time, it corresponds to about 10 billion light years. And basically we're probing the way matter is distributed on that sort of scale. The only thing we have to be a little bit careful of is to factor in the expansion of in the universe in all this. So those fluctuations today would have that scale, whereas when we run them back in time to the time when the fluctuations in the microwave background were produced, everything was a factor of a thousand smaller.
So the presence of these structures, these large scale structures that we see in the universe, strings of galaxies and clumps of galaxies, back when the universe was very, very young, could have been simply the difference between a tiny quantum fluctuation one way or the other.
That's absolutely right. So, I mean, of course, if we look at the way galaxies, for example, are distributed today, things don't look at all smooth. Things are, you know, what we call very, very non-linear. Whereas when we look at the microwave background, the fluctuations are very smooth. They're sort of one part in 100,000, as you said. And the reason for that is basically the fact that if you have a blob of matter, which is, so where there's more matter than the average in the universe, what it will tend to do is accrete surrounding matter. So these fluctuations in the matter actually grow via a process of gravitational accretion, just attracting other matter. And this is what we believe happens. So these fluctuations started off very small. So the primordial level was at the sort of level of a one part in 100,000. But because of accreting surrounding matter, it grew up to give us very large-scale fluctuations that we now see in the large-scale structure of the universe.
This was always a problem with our understanding of the Big Bang cosmology, as I understand it. If you take a lot of energy, like the energy of the entire universe, and cram it into a very, very small point, the singularity as we understand it, which we call the Big Bang, and then let it expand. The problem was that if you had all that energy in one small spot, it was very, very, very hot, and therefore presumably very, very smooth. You couldn't have some little parts of that tiny volume with all that energy comprised together being slightly higher than the other, because it would all just be smoothed out. It would be thermally smoothed out and become very, very homogeneous. So in order to produce these large clumpiness, this large-scale structure, this clumpiness that we see in the universe, we needed something different. We need some kind of difference between one point in the early universe and another. And so we had to appeal to physics, and it's these quantum fluctuations. Tell us a little bit about these quantum fluctuations themselves. What are they?
Well,
first of all, have I got that right? I just made a statement. I didn't actually ask a question.
That is basically true. So, the most important advance here really was this idea of inflation, cosmological inflation in the early universe. So perhaps I should say a bit more about that first of all. The problem is that normally we would expect matter gravitationally to attract other matter. So if you throw a ball up in the air, while it's rising up, it slows down, eventually turns around and comes back to us. And the universe should actually be acting in the same way. So the universe is expanding, we know it is, but because of the attraction of all the matter in the universe, it ought to be slowing down in its expansion. In the early universe, we believe that because of the presence of a strange kind of matter, which was effectively almost repulsive gravitationally, it had a large pressure, which could, the effect of this pressure was to basically change the gravitational attraction into a gravitational repulsion. And the effect of that is that this expanding object, instead of attracting itself, it effectively tried to blow itself apart. So the effect of this is that a very, very small region of space, which is originally so small that everything had time to communicate with itself, it's what we say to be in causal contact with itself, that very small region can be blown up by an enormous amount, something like 10 to the 50 or so in size.
10 to the 50, that's crazy, that's one with 50 zeros.
That's one with 50 zeros, an absolutely enormous amount. It can get blown up basically to encompass our entire observable universe. This is why we think that the microwave background is basically so smooth when we look at it. If this period of inflation, cosmological inflation, hadn't happened in the early universe, it would have been a real mystery why, when we look at different regions of the sky, why the temperature is so uniform. So we actually needed inflation to understand that very basic property that the universe is so smooth on large scales.
And simply by multiplying a very, very small effect, these quantum effects, these quantum processes, which we know operate at very, very low energies, very, very small energies and very, very low scales, by something like 10 to the 50, we can get something very, very small becoming something very, very big.
At least
noticeable, so that, you know, things like gravitational accretion can occur on reasonable time.
That's right. So, there's two aspects. The 10 to the 50 refers to the sort of length scale of these fluctuations, so they get stretched out. But the other thing is that they can be amplified in, their amplitude can get larger as well. And this happens in a very specific time during inflation. So basically, as modes get stretched out during the cosmological inflation, the quantum character is basically replaced by, once they get stretched to a certain critical length scale, they become essentially classical in character. And they have an amplitude, which is just basically determined by the rate at which the universe was expanding at that time. So that's what's setting the basic amplitude of the fluctuations. And then later on, as matter accretes due to gravity, the amplitude can get boosted further.
When we look at the sky, when we talk about the sky, we're talking about the entire sky that we can see. with our satellites, we see these fluctuations. What do we actually measure? We measure the differential temperature, but we're talking about fluctuations at various scales. So we want to measure small fluctuations and then slightly bigger fluctuations and even bigger fluctuations. So what is it that we actually measure? What is the data that we receive that we use to make these predictions about the universe?
So the way these experiments work is basically by they scan across the sky to produce a survey of the full sky. So at any time, what you're basically measuring is the temperature along a single direction. And then as time goes by, the instrument repoints to a different direction and then measures the temperature somewhere else. And then there's a whole load of data analysis steps that have to go on to try and convert that data, which is essentially a time series, to convert that into, first of all, a map of what the temperature looks like on the sky, and then try and extract various statistical properties of that map. The easiest way actually to confront the data with our theoretical models is to ask what is the sort of amplitude of the fluctuations in temperature as a function of angular scale. And we do this basically by looking for blobs within the temperature at a fixed angular scale and ask what's the amplitude of those.
When we talk about amplitude, do we mean how many there are or how strong they are?
Sorry, how strong they are.
Right. Yeah,
that's right.
How deep the temperature difference is, essentially, or how, you know.
That's right. And what we basically find is a very interesting dependence on the strength of the fluctuation with angular scale. And in particular, we find a sort of oscillatory character whereby certain angular scales seem to have much more power than other angular scales. And this is reflecting also something very interesting that happened in the early universe. It's basically reflecting the acoustic physics of how the primordial plasma, so the stuff that made up the universe, when the temperature was greater than a few thousand degrees, it's reflecting the dynamics of that plasma. So effectively, this is like doing acoustic physics. It's the physics of sound waves bouncing around, but these are sound waves on cosmological scales. And so these huge wavelengths. And what we're basically doing when we look at the fluctuation amplitude as a function of scale, we're measuring the amplitude of these sound waves with different wavelengths.
So these are sound waves in the primordial plasma when the universe was very, very young, soon after the universe came into being. We should point out, of course, that when we talk about acoustic in this sense, we're talking about longitudinal waves in a medium. Because we all know that we can't, you know, sound doesn't travel in a pure vacuum. But we're not talking about a pure vacuum here. We're talking about this very hot, energized plasma when the universe was very, very young. So we have these sort of sound waves which are bouncing around in the primordial plasma of the universe, and that somehow gets imprinted on how strong a particular sized CMB fluctuation is. What does that tell us?
That's right. So, I mean, one way to think about this, imagine waves on a violin string, for example. These are what are called standing waves. So the whole string sort of vibrates in unison, and at certain points that the string is undisturbed, whereas a little bit later in time, it's at maximum displacement. And the time period between when it goes from zero displacement to maximum displacement depends on the frequency of the wave, or equivalently the wavelength of the standing wave. So the same thing goes on in the primordial plasma, in that fluctuations on different angular scales will vibrate in an acoustic manner on different time scales. So what's happening is that at the time when basically the fluctuations in the microwave background are imprinted on the sky. And this, I should have said this, this occurs basically when the universe stops being very opaque and very ionized. As the temperature cools, basically neutral atoms form and the radiation stops interacting with matter. It travels unimpeded, and that's what we see in the microwave.
The universe becomes transparent.
The universe becomes transparent, that's right. So what we see is conditions at that time when it just became transparent. And the fluctuations on different length scales, which are bouncing our sound waves with different frequencies, at the time the universe became transparent, some of those sound waves are just caught at their maximum displacement, and some are just caught at zero displacement. So those that are caught at maximum displacement give us features, angular features on the microwave background sky, which are maximal in amplitude, whereas those that are caught at zero displacement basically give no fluctuation on that particular scale. So what we can really read off from that is something about both the composition of the universe, so how much matter there is, how much of the ordinary matter, the stuff that we're made of, basically atoms, and how much of this mysterious dark matter that we know must be present, basically to keep galaxies bound together. We can, for example, measure the relative proportions of those. But we can also say something about the sort of global geometry of the universe. So remember, we're talking about these sound waves, which have a spatial wavelength associated with them. But what we see on the microwave sky is an angular wavelength, if you like. And the relation between those depends basically on what we call the angular diameter distance back to when the universe became transparent. So that's one of the key things we can actually measure from the microwave background fluctuations, this angular diameter distance, which is telling us something about the geometry of the universe. Just to put a bit more on that, if the universe were, for example, if the geometry were sort of Euclidean, like the simple geometry that we learn at school, then there's a very simple parallel straight lines remain parallel and never converge onto each other. Sound waves of a given wavelength in the primordial plasma will appear with a very characteristic angular scale on the sky today. But if instead, say we curved the universe up, so it was like the three-dimensional analogue of the surface of a sphere, then what we find is that light rays tend to sort of converge together and there's a focusing effect. And what that does, it tends to make fluctuations on the microwave sky look larger in angular scale than they would do in a Euclidean universe. The thing is, theorists can predict rather accurately what physical size these sound waves ought to have in the early universe. And then you can read off from looking at their angular size, you can read off what the geometry of the universe is.
It's a remarkable amount of information you can get by looking at just essentially a two-dimensional map of the cosmic microwave background, just measuring, you know, how strong fluctuations of various sizes are. It's a phenomenal amount of physics which you learn from this.
That's right. I mean, I think it's fair to say that the microwave background really has revolutionized our understanding of the cosmos. And, okay, there's been a lot of complementary data sets that have been helping out to do this, but the microwave background is such a nice, clean probe of the earliest times in the universe that it really has been invaluable in this quest to try and understand the properties of the universe.
What's next?
Well, so for microwave background research, one very exciting thing that's going to happen is a new satellite is going to be launched. So this is a European satellite called the Planck satellite, hopefully going to be launched later towards the end of this year. And compared to current observations, this will measure fluctuations on much smaller angular scales and with much better precision. So really what we hope to do with Planck is to map out these fluctuations in temperature very, very accurately and basically extract all of the cosmological information that is present in the temperature of the microwave background. So this is a very exciting prospect. And for example, we'll improve our understanding of what the universe is made of and what its geometry. We hope to understand that at the sort of percent level after the Planck data is analysed.
Fantastic. We can't wait. Thank you very much indeed for taking the time to talk to us.
You're welcome.
Thanks, Nick.
And actually, Dave, I'm particularly excited about the European Space Agency's Planck spacecraft because that's what I do in my day job.
Uh-huh.
So I'm going to try to bring some special Planck interviews from behind the scenes later on in the year.
Right, and what still has to be done in the lead-up to launch?
Well, we've now integrated the instruments which form the Planck spacecraft together with the telescope, and during the summer we're going to be testing them, making sure that all the instruments work as we expect they do, tuning various parts of them to make sure that they work a little bit better. So all that has to be done and tuned in order to verify that everything still works before we send it off to Kourou in French Guiana for the launch campaign.
Okay, well, thank you very much, and looking forward to asking you more questions as the year goes by. But of course, there's someone waiting here who is always answering our questions. It's Dr. Tim O'Brien, and Nick went to ask your questions.
Yes, Ask an Astronomer Time with Dr. Tim O'Brien. Thank you very much again, Tim, for answering questions.
Hello.
First question comes from Mark, and he writes, as I understand it, our solar system orbits the supermassive black hole in the center of our galaxy. So there must be a large force of gravity on our solar system. Why aren't our planets on a massive ellipse towards the center of the galaxy?
Okay, so I guess the question's saying, imagining this position, which we believe to be the case, that there's this massive black hole at the centre of our galaxy, and he's sort of saying, well, you know, why aren't the planets just orbiting the centre of the galaxy rather than orbiting the sun?
Yeah.
I think that's what that's the point. Although, I mean, he's right, we think there's this massive black hole, and that black hole would be many times the mass of the Earth, mass of the Sun, I should say, probably millions of times the mass of the Sun, maybe more. And in fact, what matters also is not just the mass of the black hole at the middle of the galaxy, it's the mass of all of the galaxy within our radius, our distance from the centre of the Milky Way. So it's all that material that's sort of inside our radius, all the mass of that stuff added up, if you like, as if it were all concentrated at the middle, more or less. And that mass is vastly greater than the mass of the Sun. So in fact, that mass is probably something like 10 to the power 11 times the mass of the Sun. So that's basically 100,000 million times the mass of the Sun. So you think, goodness me, you know, all that extra mass, surely the force of gravity from the Milky Way dominates over the force of gravity from the Sun. Well, in fact, if you look at the numbers, the force of gravity, if you can remember your basic physics, Newton's law of gravity, tells you that the force between two objects of masses, say M1 and M2 or something, that force is given by capital G, it's a gravitational constant, times each of the two masses, M1 times M2, divided by the square of the distance between them. So it depends on the masses of the objects and the distance between them squared. So what we're interested in answering this question, is whether which force dominates over the other. So we have to look at, effectively, the mass of the Sun divided by the distance from the Earth to the Sun squared. That's basically going to give us the force of gravity between the Earth and the Sun, compared to the mass of the Milky Way divided by the distance from the Sun to the centre of the Milky Way squared.
We should point out that you can consider all the mass in the Milky Way galaxy inside the solar orbit as a single mass at the centre of the galaxy.
Yeah. So that's the assumption in this sort of simplified model, yeah. So if you do that, you put in those numbers, well, you've got basically for the mass of the Sun, it's 2 times 10 to the power 30 kilograms. And the distance from the Earth to the Sun is 1.5 times 10 to the 11 meters, an astronomical unit. And then for the mass of the, Milky Way, we'll take 10 to the 11 solar masses, 100,000 million. Times the mass of the Sun, and we'll take the radius, the distance from the Sun to the centre of the Milky Way is about 8 kiloparsecs, so, you know, 24,000 light years or so. Put those numbers in, the ratio of those two gravitational forces is about 30 million or so. So in other words, the force of gravity between the Earth and the Sun is, you know, tens of millions times more than the force of gravity between the Sun and the centre of the Milky Way.
Yeah, simply because the Sun, even though it is much, much lighter, less in mass than obviously everything else in the galaxy in terms of a solar circle, is just that much closer to us.
Absolutely. So in fact, yeah, it's 10 to the 11 times more massive, the Milky Way, but the centre of the Milky Way is actually 10 to the 9 times farther away. And because it goes as the square, that 10 to the 9 becomes 10 to the 18. Mm-hmm. So there's a factor 10 to the 18 due to the distance, and there's a factor 10 to the 11 that works in the opposite sense due to the mass. And that still means that you're a factor 10 to the 7 times more gravity from the Sun than there is from the Milky Way.
Yeah. So that means that we take more notice of the Sun's gravity than the rest of the Milky Way galaxy.
Yeah, that's right. We're just that close to the Sun that the Sun matters more. So in fact, therefore, the planets do orbit in ellipses, in fact, about the Sun. And of course, then the Sun and the group of planets and the local group of stars and so on, then themselves will orbit around the Milky Way. Mm. So in a sense, you know, he asks, why don't we just travel in this massive orbit about the center of Milky Way? Well, we are, actually. If you can imagine the planets doing these little orbits around the Sun, cycling around the Sun, and then that whole thing just sort of traveling out in a little sort of helical pattern, if you like, about the center of the Milky Way. That's how we are. That's how we're moving. And I think maybe interesting just to quickly mention some numbers in terms of how fast these things happen. How long does it take us to travel around the centre of the Milky Way? Well, it takes us about 200 million years. The Sun travels around the Milky Way about once every 200 million years or so, which actually means that if you think about it, the Sun and the Earth, the planets, are about 5 billion years old, so that's 5,000 million years. Then in fact we've got, you know, every 200 million years we go once round, so every 1,000 million years we've gone five times round. So in fact we've gone round the middle of the Milky Way about 25 times or so since the Sun and the planets were born. So, you know, it's not insignificant. We've travelled around a number of times over the course of the lifetime of the Earth. In terms of the speeds we're travelling at, well, perhaps just working our way out from, you know, we know the Earth is spinning. It takes 24 hours to spin around once on its axis. So you can work out, you know, take the circumference of the Earth at the equator, let's say, and divide that by the spin period, 24 hours, and you get the speed at which the Earth's surface is moving. That's about half a kilometre per second, something like that. It's about 1500 kilometers an hour at the equator, and it's less as you work your way up towards the poles.
That's relative to the center of the Earth.
Relative to the center of the Earth. So you're sort of spinning at that speed. We're sort of all moving east if we were on the equator at about half a kilometer a second, 1500 kilometers an hour. The Earth then, as you imagine, the Earth's orbiting the Sun, that speed is about 30 kilometers a second, which is about 100,000 kilometers an hour. So much faster. So we've gone from half a kilometer a second rotation speed to 30 kilometers a second orbital speed about the Sun. And then you think about the Sun itself, with the planets orbiting it, the Sun itself moving around the center of the Milky Way. Well, that speed is something like 220 kilometers a second. So you've gone from sort of half a kilometer per second spin, to 30 kilometers per second orbital about the Sun to 220 kilometers per second orbital about the center of the Milky Way. So all these sort of motions are happening simultaneously.
That's interesting.
Yeah.
It's roughly an order of magnitude.
It is. Yeah. Something along those lines. Yeah.
Ah, very good. Well, thank you very much for that. And thank you to Mark for the question. Next question comes from Chris Revy, and he writes, if the universe originated from one central point in the Big Bang, why do we have colliding galaxies?
Well, just to say, first of all, I think this question was probably stimulated by a press release recently from the Space Telescope Science Institute, from the Hubble Space Telescope, to celebrate their 18th anniversary of HST operating. And what they did was release 59 different views of colliding galaxies smashing into one another. Lovely pictures, feature on Astronomy Picture of the Day as well. And just to answer his question, what he's basically saying is, okay, if the universe originated from one central point in the Big Bang, I mean, we probably ought to point out that that's not really the best interpretation of the Big Bang, thinking about one central point. In our understanding of the way that would work, the Big Bang would have happened everywhere.
Yes. There is no central point because all points are central.
There's no particular point. It's hard to imagine. We sort of envisage the Big Bang happening over there somewhere and everything sort of expanding out away from it. But
everything was over there.
Yeah. And the Big Bang happened as much in your pocket as it did in, you know, on the other side of the universe. everything expands away from everything else is the best way to think about it. So any two points in space are moving apart from each other in this large-scale cosmological picture. Okay,
but that's the hint, though, isn't it? It's large-scale.
That's absolutely right. And that's why, you know, when I say, and this is the problem that Chris refers to, is you think about everything expanding away from each other. How the heck can you have galaxies banging into each other? How can they be moving towards each other? And in fact, you might take that argument one step further and say, well, if everything's expanding away from everything else, why am I not expanding away from you at the moment? You don't seem to be getting any farther away from me at the moment. Maybe we are slightly or something, you know. This is the question. And in fact, what the answer to this is really to do with whether it's related to the last question. In fact, it's to do with whether things are gravitationally bound is the thing we refer to. So it's the fact that these galaxies that are colliding together are sufficiently close together that the force of gravity between them dominates over the expansion of space-time, over the expanding universe, and they can actually, galaxies can orbit one another in groups and clusters and even crash into one another as we see in these pictures. In the case of me and you, the forces that determine the way we are and things, perhaps are things like atomic forces stop my body expanding with the expansion of the universe, that dominates, and gravity within the solar system would dominate as well over the cosmological expansion. So we see groups and clusters of galaxies where gravity dominates and where they can collide together. The classic example locally, the Andromeda Galaxy is M31, is a nearby large spiral galaxy. It's the galaxy that you can see with the unaided eye. You know, it's the farthest you can see without using a telescope. You can just see that little smudge of light in the sky. And therefore the farthest back in time you can see as well with your own eyes. But that's moving towards us. It's not expanding away from us like distant galaxies are. It's moving towards us. It'll actually merge with the Milky Way in about three billion years. So in fact, probably before the sun dies, before the sun expands to become a red giant, we'll merge with the Andromeda galaxy. So this sort of thing happens all the time. It's happened perhaps, in fact, more commonly in the past in the universe. And we think that, you know, what we often see are the merger of two spiral galaxies, so disc-like galaxies with spiral arms, lots of dust. Those things can merge together. We see them merge together. That can actually stimulate a burst of star formation. So you see many new stars being born in these mergers. It can also cause material to flow, we think, into the central engine, the black hole at the core of these galaxies. And it can actually perhaps trigger active galactic nuclei. So these sort of quasar-like objects where you get this incredible brightening from the core of the galaxy, which then vastly outshines the rest of the galaxy. And in fact, we think the merger of spirals is what results in the formation of elliptical galaxies. So when we look around the sky and we see different shapes of galaxies, we see these disc-like ones like our Milky Way, where the stars orbit the Milky Way in, you know, roughly circular orbits in a plane. We also see these other type of galaxies, elliptical galaxies, where the stars, the planes of the orbits of the stars are oriented more randomly. And so you get a sort of three-dimensional, perhaps like a sort of rugby ball or American football-shaped object with all the planes of orbits more randomly oriented. We think those things are formed by merging two spirals. So you get these nice uniform disc-like galaxies crash into each other. The gravity of, you know, the interaction causes the orbits to be completely mixed up. It causes a burst of star formation. A lot of the gas and dust gets either used up in forming new stars or expelled from the galaxy entirely into intergalactic space. And you end up with these gas poor, very little interstellar medium, very little stuff between the stars in these elliptical galaxies. So it's a very, very, very important process in the history and the evolution of the universe, the collision and merger of galaxies.
Mm. So it's again a question of scale. Two galaxies close to each other would feel their respective gravitational forces much more than, or rather, that would be much more important than the expansion of the universe.
Yeah, and galaxies on a much larger distance from each other will be, that force of gravity will be much weaker and the expansion of the universe wins out and they expand away from each other, yeah.
Very good. Next question comes from Malcolm Powell, and he writes, how do people get into astronomy these days? And he wants to know both from an amateur and a professional perspective.
Good question. If people are interested in astronomy, how can you engage with it more? How can you become an astronomer in some sense, whether you're paid to do it, as we're lucky to be paid to do it at the moment, or whether you just want to do it for fun, actually, and, you know, in your spare time? Well, in terms of the professional side, in terms of getting paid to do astronomy, there's a pretty good website that the Royal Astronomical Society in the UK host on a pretty good webpage that they describe what you should go through, what process you should go through. I would say the typical thing is to work, you know, if you're at school, you would choose subjects, concentrate on your science subjects and particularly your maths, I would say. I think maths is pretty fundamental to physical sciences like astronomy. Do as well as you can at school in these subjects. Go to university, study, I would say, probably physics. You can study astronomy. There are undergraduate courses which concentrate on astronomy particularly. You can do maths. I mean, you know, if you're particularly mathematically inclined, you can study maths at undergraduate degree level and then still go on to concentrate on its application to astronomy. So either, you know, maths, physics, astronomy or astrophysics, those subjects typically would be what you'd choose, I would say, in the main, to do astronomy. And, you know, depending on what country you're from, that might take a varying number of years, 3-4 years, something along those lines, maybe 5 years. You've then got to do as well as you can at that, and then choose to do some postgraduate study. So we'll have both done PhDs at some point. How long did your PhD take?
Mine took, I think, 4 years.
Right, okay. So mine was supposed to be 3 years, and eventually I got round to writing it up after about 4 years.
Yeah,
and I think, you know, in some countries it's a little bit longer. People take maybe 5 years, sometimes even a few years longer than that occasionally, I think.
Certainly in the, even doing a PhD differs where you are in the world. And yeah. In the UK or the Commonwealth system, it's simply a piece of sustained original research. And so you go away and you study something for 3-4 years and write it up as a thesis, and you're given a doctorate. In the States, I think you also have to do some more postgraduate papers, more classwork, yeah. more exams,
yeah.
In addition to writing a thesis.
Yeah, that's right. So I'm effectively just writing this big book about one particular topic, and at the end of the day, the end of the 3 year, 3, 4, 5 years, you know, you're probably, you know, should be a world expert really on the subject that you've picked. You probably know more than you'd have a supervisor who would have guided you through that process, but you may well know more than your supervisor does about that specific topic, certainly about the details of some of the things you've achieved in that work. But it should be, the point is to do something new, something original, a new piece of work, whether it be reliant on observations or on theoretical interpretations of other people's observations. At the end of that process, you get awarded a PhD, you go through your examination, usually some form of oral examination. People read the book and that you've written, the thesis, and they ask you lots of detailed questions about it, and you get awarded your PhD. And then actually, from that point on, it's still, the story's not ended, because you don't generally get some sort of permanent job in astronomy then. You typically have to do fixed-term contract research posts, and maybe lasting 2 or 3 years perhaps, and you might have to go through several of those. And then if you're looking to work permanently in astronomy, usually, commonly, what you'd be looking for is a job in a university, so working as a lecturer, teaching physics and astronomy and so on to other undergraduates, but also carrying out your own research, supervising research students and so on. There are some jobs in observatories, so the actual, you know, the observatories that do observations, that astronomers use to make their observations, will also have staff astronomer jobs, where often your role would be to help develop instrumentation or help visiting astronomers use those facilities, and then you would have a proportion of the time available to do your own research as well, and you'd be expected to do that. I think that's probably the range of, does that give a fair idea of a professional astronomer?
That's the professional route, I think, yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
So on terms of doing astronomy, you know, because it's an interesting thing to do, even if you've got another job that pays the wages, pays for your food and so on, I think the thing to do there, probably if you want to get into that, I would say there's lots of information out there, and there's many ways which you can access that these days. There's still some really good high quality magazines, typically monthly magazines, that are available that I would recommend people purchase. So things like Sky and Telescope or Astronomy Now or the Sky at Night magazine, for example, are very good, and they were full of articles about current issues in astronomy, news and views and so on, and also, you know, what's around in the night sky. If that's what you're interested in, if you want to know what are these things that I can see in the sky when it's clear, then you probably want to get hold of one of these software packages that we talked about before that show you what's up in the night sky at any given time. If you want to move a little bit beyond just making visual observations yourself, you want to get yourself a telescope perhaps, then there's, I think we have some resources on our website at Jodrell actually, which talk about choosing a telescope or how to use binoculars, for example, for viewing the night sky, and give you some advice and guidance in what to choose and what you might see and so on. And then I think a good idea is to think about getting together with some like-minded individuals. You can always learn a lot from people who've had, you know, many years of experience, and the way to do that on this side is probably to look at a local astronomical society. And in the UK, for example, there's a good website that's run by a group called the Federation of Astronomical Societies, which brings together in one place a list of links to all the local societies with links to their own web pages, and gives you contact details and so on for getting in touch. And you probably find there's one within a reasonable drive of wherever you live, and those people will usually organize meetings, say once a month or something, where they'll have external speakers visiting, astronomers will come and give talks, and then they'll have star party sessions where you can perhaps even use somebody else's telescope and get a feel for whether it's something you might want to invest some money in before you splash out yourself.
So I think astronomy is one of those things that you can get a good taste of what you, what it's like to be certainly an observational astronomer well before you outlay lots of cash and buying kit. I mean, it's you can start learning immediately. You can go out at night, and as long as it's not cloudy, you can take a star atlas and start learning.
Yeah, and in fact, it's one of those sciences that you can make real contributions to, without being, you know, without having it as a professional job, if you like. You can make research level contributions with quite small telescopes and, you know, CCD cameras and so on. It is it's a reasonably significant investment of money, maybe several thousand pounds needed to get yourself a telescope and a CCD camera, but you can discover supernovae and monitor asteroids and so on. That, you know, it's a useful contribution to research astronomy, and there's not many sciences that you can say that for, I think. Yeah. There was a good, I don't know whether you saw the story that was recently in the news here in the UK that was about a new observatory that was opened up in the Kielder Forest in Northumberland.
The darkest sky in the UK.
Yeah, so they looked at this sort of light pollution maps and found, you know, which bit of the sky in England was the darkest, and they've put this new observatory up there, I think run by local astronomers, and give the public an opportunity to go and have a look through a telescope and so on, and to be able to do some, you know, interesting research level sort of science from such a site with just a, you know, relatively modest outlay in terms of the actual telescope and the equipment.
Some of these magazines you also mentioned, they provide projects or goals or things for people to do. So they might say, okay, you've got this size telescope. You might be asking yourself, what on earth do I do with it? I can look at stars, I can look at galaxies, but if I want to feel like I'm achieving something, you know, solid, or, you know, producing new data or something like that, you know, what can I do? And these publications often suggest, well, watch this variable star, plot it, see what happens. There are all sorts of interesting transient events which you can spot. For instance, like you mentioned, comets and asteroids and that sort of thing. Yeah. So the bright sky, the near sky, is accessible with modest sized telescopes. And it's an interesting point you hear from some astronomers. Professional astronomers are always keen to use the big 8-meter telescopes to probe the distant and faint universe. And the bright universe has been recently rediscovered, so to speak. Yeah, realizing there's an awful lot going on, which you can't use an 8-meter telescope for, because
That's right.
The objects would be far too bright and it would be blinding. Yes.
You'd have to stand there with a bit of cardboard blocking most of the mirrors.
Yes. Yes.
Yeah. No, it's right. I mean, the small telescope astronomy is still a very interesting field. I mean, you know, one of the areas I work in NOVI, Nova Explosions, and we're still reliant on astronomers, you know, amateur astronomers who scan the skies looking for these things. We still rely on them for discovering them. So it's a great thing to, it's a great science to get involved with, I would say, at that sort of local level. I mean, the other thing I would just mention as well is if you want to take that a bit further and become something a bit more formal in terms of your, training, even if you're not thinking about going down the, professional astronomy, route, it's worth thinking about taking some of these, short courses that are offered. And in fact, we do offer some from Jodrell, sort of distance learning courses that are delivered over the internet, intended for people to do part time. Some that include visiting Jodrell using the radio telescopes at Jodrell, themselves. In fact, I've got a group of students who at the moment are, mapping the Milky Way with our 7-meter radio telescope from home, from the back bedroom.
Oh, that's cool.
and it's not just Jodrell that offer those courses as well. There's universities in the UK, Liverpool John Moores, University of Central Lancs, the Open University offer similar courses in the UK, and other universities would obviously offer those in other countries as well. So it's worth looking out for those sorts of, maybe these internet-based courses, but also evening courses offered by local colleges or universities, just to maybe put some of your understanding of things on a bit more of a formal educational footing if you want to take it to that level.
And it's relatively easy to do. I mean, now with the internet and communications being as they are, studying at a distance has become easier than it ever has been.
I think that's right. Yep, that's true. So it's, popular thing to do. And it's, you know, it's typically people who are doing those are not looking to get into astronomy on a full-time basis, but some are, and some in fact manage to achieve that. So they go through that sort of part-time route, by following this route through, and then manage to, you know, they're good enough, they transfer across and jump onto the professional astronomy bandwagon as well, and get themselves a job in an observatory.
So there you go, Malcolm. I hope that helps. Thank you very much, Tim, for answering that and the previous questions.
No problem.
Thanks, Nick and Tim. And hopefully Nick will be back with us live for the June edition of the Jodcast, when we will have the night sky and, of course, the news with Megan. But thanks must go now to Martin Watts, who gave us our intro-outro joke. If you have any suggestions or anything that you'd like to hear on the intro-outro, or you have any taxing questions yourself that you'd like to set to all of the other Jodcast listeners, then send them in. We do appreciate your feedback, your emails, your Facebook, whatever. Just let us know that you're out there.
So just go to our website, www.jodcast.net, and use the feedback form to get in contact with us.
Yes, please. So thank you to all of you, our listeners, for downloading us, and we look forward to gracing your speakers in June. So until then, take good care of yourselves, and don't forget to jod on. So, before the Jodcast, I asked you, how many astronomers does it take to change a street lamp bulb? And the answer? 2. One to take out the old bulb and... Well, actually, make that 1.